Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
If you thought Irish cooking was dull and all about potatoes and cabbage, hold on to your hat. You'll hear all about it today on A Taste of the Past. Irish cooking has a long and storied history, which is probably not known to many people. I think most people can't get past the potatoes and then the potato famine. But I have with me today the grand dame of Irish cooking and cuisine, Dorina Allen. Dorina is the preeminent authority on Irish cuisine and the owner of the renowned cooking school Ballymaloe and a wonderful teacher. She is a popular TV cooking personality and the author of more than 5 books, winning many awards, including the prestigious EuroTok Award for Outstanding Contribution to the Irish Culinary Sector. She has a new edition out of her popular book, Irish Traditional Cooking, which has a wonderful section on the history of Irish food. Dorina, welcome.
Thank you.
I know that you're in town here in New York City from Ireland, from Ballymaloe, to give an award, a poetry award, in conjunction with a literary fest and with the Moth magazine. Tell us a little bit about that award and about the literary fest.
Well, the award is the Ballymaloe International Poetry Award, and this is our 3rd year to give it. Actually, we're just announcing the competition this time, and it's the first time we've come to New York to launch it. So, because for the last 2 years we've been doing this in conjunction with the Moth Poetry Magazine here in Ireland, and we've had entries from all over the world, so we thought, well, we should take it global and launch it in New York as well as, obviously, at Ballymaloe in Ireland.
Now, does the poetry contest have anything to do with food?
Well, not necessarily. The poems can be... It has to be a new poem, obviously, and it must be an original, obviously. But if it's about food, well, that's very nice, too.
another dimension.
It's another dimension, but it's not essential.
Okay. However, the literary fest that you've sponsored, that is really quite interesting.
That was a literary festival. We did a literary festival of food and wine that we did at Ballymaloe over the Maybank holiday weekend. It was absolutely extraordinary. We decided to do a literary festival in between Ballymaloe House and the grain store at Ballymaloe, which is a wonderful facility for concerts and all sorts of things, and also the Ballymaloe Cookery School. And of course, when it was connected to Ballymaloe, it had to be about wine and food. So it's amazing, because there have been literary festivals all over the world and food festivals and wine festivals and tasting, but there didn't seem to have been the 3 together. And a lot of the time, the food festivals aren't necessarily about literature as well. So there are so many so many thousands of cookbooks and books on wine and everything, but some of them are, you know, if you never picked up a wooden spoon, you could sit up in bed reading the prose and be licking your lips. And there are people like, so we had speakers literally from all over the world. We had Marta Jeffrey, we had Claudine Roden, the sort of grand dames of the
right.
thing. Stephanie Alexander, Alice Waters was also coming in the end, actually, because of the fire at Chippenese, she couldn't come. But we had David Thompson and on and on. So we had this amazing lineup of speakers. and literally people came in from all over the world, and it just went into orbit. And we were very fortunate that the weather, which is always a factor in Ireland, was brilliant that weekend. So we had hoped for about 2,500 to 3,000 people. You know, over 8,000 people turned up over the weekend. We had a whole fringe element to it as well. So you're not normally meant to have a fringe for a few years, but we had a fringe on the first time, because in a way the word literary can put many people off. You know, they think, well, maybe that's not for me. But because we had a whole fringe with an amazing sort of market and all kinds of other events, many of them free and something for kids and lots of educational stuff, you know, everybody felt they could come. So it was just extraordinary. Yeah. We're going to do it again next year on May the 16th to the 18th in 2014.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, in looking over the list of speakers, I noticed that there are a handful of speakers who actually have been on our radio network on other shows, not on my show necessarily, but on some of the other shows.
Yes.
So, I mean, you really have touched a lot of different corners of gathering people who have knowledge in different respects. The literature, you speak about books that, you know, about food. It's amazing where you will find food. And I know one of your speakers, Dorothy Cashman, we were talking about that earlier.
Yes.
She was a former student of yours.
That's right, at the cooking school.
But she, and you mention also in your book often about the author, I'm going to get it wrong,
Maria Edgeworth.
Maria Edgeworth, right.
Yes, Edgeworth, yes. But,
and she writes so much about food, and you get a sense of food in the period. Well, look at, and even looking at, well, you know, the popular series here, Downton Abbey, and how people,
yes,
how many people were involved with the food in that, and, you know, above all of everything else, because it's such an integral part of life.
Well, of everything. Yeah. Well, absolutely. Well, you know, right back to you go back 9,000 years ago to when people, you know, came to Ireland the first time, and then they were the hunter-gatherers. But actually, Dorothy Cushman, who you just mentioned a few moments ago, she has looked very interestingly at a period that in many of the books on Irish food history and so on had been kind of slightly airbrushed out. And that was went back and found many of the manuscript cookbooks from the great houses and so on. There's a wonderful collection in the National Library in Dublin, and also there's some of these manuscript cookbooks are still held in houses around the country. I mean, the earliest one, I think, is at Birr Castle, the Parsons family. This has been added to since the late 1600s. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's an incredible history of the food in Ireland down through all of those ages right up to the present day. So, and these were a lot, of course, handwritten. Very often they were handwritten by the woman of the house, because often the cook would be illiterate. And so when you read I've had spent quite a lot of time studying these as well, and in Birr Castle, that particularly the Parsons one there, you know, some of the recipes have it's amazing, the spices and everything actually that they have in them, and they were very keen on rose water. But I saw there was one recipe with 1/4 pound of caraway seeds in it. Well, that would kill you. So obviously the lady of the house didn't actually cook, and the cook of the house at that time may not have been literate, and obviously would have cooked by touch and so on. So there was a bit of guesswork going on. And in some other recipes there was tons of rose water. But fascinating what was available in terms of the range of spices. And of course all of those houses as well would have had kitchen gardens and game larders and orchards, and there were many recipes for pickling, and of course for medicines as well, and that kind of thing, for cures, for all sorts of things.
And it's interesting because the manuscripts, and Barbara Wheaton has mentioned this, you and I were talking about her early. Barbara does a wonderful course up in Boston about how to read cookbooks and how to read manuscripts.
Yes.
But from these manuscripts, we learn so much about culture of the time.
Exactly. But also, because they were handwritten, they were not like cookbooks are now, going to go onto a shelf in a shop. Mm-hmm. So in a way, basically, people, they were more intimate in a way. People had little notes in the margins about, and obviously they shared recipes as well between different houses. And you'd have one, you know, a sort of very good receipt or whatever, and thing, and then maybe something, a derogatory comment about something else, which obviously they would have trusted wouldn't have got back to the owner. But, and obviously the cooks sometimes would have come with the family when they were visiting abroad even as well, which is interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in so many cultures, these recipes for the food of that land are passed down through oral tradition.
Exactly.
And to have a manuscript, to have it written and preserved is just a wonderful treasure.
And also, you know, when you think of the perception of Irish food as being, as you say, kind of rooted in the potato and corned beef and cabbage and all of that, the food, the sophistication of the food that was eaten in these great houses was just extraordinary. And not only the range of ingredients and spices, as I said, that they had, but also they were, you know, obviously the families travelled, they went on the grand tour in Europe and so on, they came back with obviously sort of at least descriptions of some of the food they'd eaten in France and Italy and Austria and so on, and gave it to the cook when they came back.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course it was all very a la mode to have, you know, French names on things and so on. So it was, it's really quite an eye-opener to see the sophistication of the menus at that time.
So we're talking of many centuries there.
Yes.
And the potato was a latecomer.
That's
being a new
right.
world food. So
yes.
There was food before the potato.
Oh, there absolutely was. And well, it depends how far back you want to go. I mean, the hunter-gatherers would have, you know, come to a forested country basically and lived on the roots and the leaves and the fish from the sea with our island nation. Of course, lots of fish and shellfish around the coasts, and then gradually the grains and cereals and so on were introduced and so on, the oats and barley, and depending on where you were in the social strata as well, whether you ate wheat, bread made of wheat, or bread made of barley.
Or notes,
that's
right?
Exactly,
dense gruel.
That's right, yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Well, for such a small country that it is so rich in its natural resources.
Exactly, and we are still so fortunate, really, even though the economy has taken quite a battering over the last number of years. We have, in Ireland, we have a very high percentage of fertile soil. We have a country that can grow an enormous amount of food. I think we produce 10 times the amount of food that we need to feed our population. So we export a lot of food.
Mm.
We have a long growing season. We have, of course, a marvellous coastline with fish and shellfish around it. So, and established markets very close to Europe. So we are very favoured in terms of producing food. And then we can grow grass like nowhere else in the world.
That's true.
So we can, you know, our dairy products and our beef and our lamb and everything are still fantastic. And we still have wonderful game. So we are favoured, as Ireland always was, really, and people came to Ireland. And then we had, in earlier times, of course, there was we were famous for what they used to call our bon bia, which are their white meats, which actually were our dairy products. And there was many different references in early manuscripts to all the different kinds of milk products and cheeses and
butter.
Butter.
I mean,
we had the biggest
Ireland,
butter market
yeah.
in the world.
Right.
Yes, was out of Cork, and there's a butter museum still in Cork. Mm. So from small little farms all around Munster, they'd make their butter on the farms, and of course the cows feeding on wonderful rich pastures with lots of wildflowers and everything in them, and they made marvelous butter, and they would bring that in on, you know, donkey and carts and on horse and carts in as far as Cork to the butter market, and there they graded it very strictly, and then it was exported all over the world to the Caribbean, to India, and so on. And you can that the butter was so stable and kept. And there's a beautiful story, actually. This is a more modern story, but in my mother-in-law Myrtle Allen's cookbook, the Ballymaloe cookbook, where this woman Mary used to come, and a local lady would deliver butter sort of once a week to the house. And my father-in-law met her one week, and he said, "You know, Mary, that was wonderful butter you brought last week." And she said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Allen, that field always made good butter." I mean, how beautiful is that? The people were so connected to the land and just noticed that when that field was, the grass was long and lush, that the butter was particularly good. So we've always, again, it's like I say, we can still grow grass like nowhere else in the world.
And it pays off.
And it pays off. So, yes. And of course, over here you can get Irish butter. You can get
Kerrygold
butter. And I was actually talking to a pastry chef yesterday and over here, and she was saying she always uses Irish butter because she gets the best results for baking. So it's very nice.
Interesting.
The tradition still lives on.
The cheeses are
yes.
wonderful. Yeah.
That's right. And
excellent.
You get actually quite a lot of our farmhouse cheeses over here now. And the one of the most interesting things that's happened in Irish recent food history is, of course, the emergence of an artisan food sector, and people, you know, making cheeses in small quantities on farm from their own milk, or from their could be cow's milk, it could be sheep's milk, goat's milk, and so on. So that's you can get a taste of that place as you go around the country. You can get a taste of that particular parish, of that particular region, from the food that's made on the farms there.
Yeah. Well, We're going to talk a little bit more about some of this artisanal movement and how everything old is new again.
Yes.
When we come back after a short break.
Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
We are back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm speaking with Dorina Allen, the Irish chef, Irish cookbook author, and owner of the Ballymaloe Cooking School with her husband. Now, you started the school in 1983, correct?
Yes. It'll be, can you believe it's going to be 30 years this coming September?
30 years.
Yeah.
Huh?
So that the years have whizzed past, and we get students literally from all over the world coming. I know I always particularly welcome American students, actually, because I know, and I say to them, well, look, for actually managing to turn up here after you've had such a ribbing over the last number of months about, you know, what are you doing going to a cooking school in Ireland? You know, how many ways to cook a potato? So, but literally, students have been coming from all over the world for a long time now. I think it's because, in a way, the cooking school is in, Ballymaloe Cooking School, is in the middle of a 100-acre organic farm. So I think there's a real craving to reconnect back with how food is produced and
right,
where
we
it comes from.
And we were talking about that right before the break, about how there is this artisanal movement there, as well as in many countries, small batch cheeses, even beers. And
craft beers, absolutely. Mm-hmm,
all kinds of small, you know, like hands-on projects, people are appreciating where the food comes from, right?
And absolutely. And I think often when I ask students why they've come to Ireland, they say it's because the school is in the middle of a farm, and they can, we have our own we have our own chickens, for example. When they're cooking in the morning, the scraps from the leftover from the food go into a hen's bucket, and they get fed to the hens and come back as eggs a few days later. So, you know, for students to sort of be able to reconnect with how food is produced. And then we have an acre of greenhouses and quite a lot of gardens. We grow, you know, we grow about 80 different things on our farm. So they can see fruit and orchards and vegetables. And we have an acre, as I said, we have an acre of greenhouses. So we can see. And also the students then, they can actually, the people on the longer course, on 3-month courses, who are training really to be chefs, actually, they, it's like total immersion. They can also, the first thing we do on the first day is we show them how to sow a seed. And then the first recipe they get is how to make compost. And they say, oh my God, you know, didn't say anything about this in the brochure. But it's really to get, shock people out of thinking the food is just something that comes wrapped in plastic off a supermarket shelf. To get to think about how the food is produced, the breed, the feed, the variety, etc. So this really thrills people, actually. They just love to reconnect again. And then we have some pigs, and we also have cows. So we milk five Jersey cows every morning.
So it's almost self-sufficient. I mean, the whole school.
Yes, do you know something? We often, particularly from now on, we often sit down to a plate of food where everything on the plate, including the butter and the cream and milk and everything, came from the farm and garden. So that's a real blessing, and so on. And then, of course, we do 3 of those 3-month certificate courses in the year, but we also do short courses, days, weekends, weeks. And people, if they're in Ireland, they can just come in for an afternoon or something.
Well, I did notice you have a wonderful series of courses which interest me, and that's the Forgotten Skills courses.
Yes.
Tell me about that one.
Well, now those are, again, it's back to this craving to reconnect, isn't it? So we've been doing these for about maybe 10 or 12 years now. These are things like how to cure a pig in a day, butchery courses and those sort of things, how to make sausage and salamis and chorizos, how to make buttered cheese and yogurt, how to beginner's guide to beekeeping, how to keep chickens in your garden, foraging courses. It's called A Walk on the Wild Side with Dorina Allen. How corny is that? But anyway, but we've been doing those for about 15 years, and actually there's really a growing, really fast growing interest in all those kind of courses again. And I think it's partly to do with the recession all over the world, where people suddenly have become to, that we've had to reevaluate our or think about our values, and suddenly we realise that, or I think appreciate the value of a degree of self-sufficiency, because a lot of people are able to do nothing. They can hardly make toast, you know.
But don't you think also it's an awareness of what we put in our bodies and the eating. I think people are really concerned, you know, especially with all the talk about the, you know, genetically modified foods and commercial fertilizers and things, that I think people are more aware of what they're eating, how it's grown.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
and they want to take back control to a certain extent. Even if you're living in a high-rise apartment somewhere, if you have a window and you have something to grow something in and light and water, you can grow something. You don't even have to have a greenhouse. And then, my God, when you sow a seed and wait for it to grow into something you can eat, you just want everybody to know that you grew it, and you want to eat it slowly, and you want everybody to tell you how wonderful you are. And it's not about just about economics. It's about a quality of life.
Yeah,
it's about an appreciation.
It,
and also it's about something you can trust. And you're quite right. We no longer can say we don't know what's going on behind the scenes in terms of food production. And, you know, particularly when food is very intensively produced, and there is an incredible, relentless pressure to bring down the price of food. And there's no such thing as cheap food. The cheap food is a myth. You know, it costs too much in health terms and socioeconomic terms and everything. You see, I was brought up, I'm now 64 years of age, and of course I was brought up, the eldest of nine, to always believe that our food should be our medicine. And my mother felt very strongly that if you didn't put the effort into the food on the table, it didn't have to be expensive, but it had to be fresh and nourishing and good and wholesome and home cooked, and so on, then you give the money to the doctor or the chemist. And we don't want to do them out of business, but basically, so that's where we are. So we've got to, in a way, we have in Ireland even, and to a great extent over here as well, we have failed several generations now by letting them out of our houses without giving them the basic life skills to actually feed themselves properly.
Right.
And it's all right in New York, because, you know, you can go to any restaurant or whatever, and you can, but, you know, we need to be able to cook, and we need to sit down around the table again and chat to each other.
I see that this is the philosophy pretty much that the school was based upon, really.
Yes.
Right? And that's
That's definitely true, and these sort of values are not just something to, I mean, the skills that we teach at the school, of course one can earn one's living from, and our students go out and become chefs and go straight into restaurants, or they write about food, or they do television or whatever, but basically these are skills for life.
Yes.
These are skills that touch your everyday life and will enhance the quality of your life, to be able to cook just also, I find as well now that students, a number of years ago, students certainly didn't want to learn how to pluck a pheasant or to skin a rabbit or something like that. And it may not be something that would, touch everybody's life. But it's become so cool again, even for the girls and so on, to be able to do these things. And the butchery classes are totally sold out. Even over here, it's the same, isn't it?
Yes. And you touched on, I think, one of the main reasons. And it's the appreciation. You should know where your food comes from.
Exactly.
And you do that job.
Yes.
You may not ever pluck a chicken again. But you have an appreciation for what this is that's on the plate. On the table.
Exactly.
It makes a big difference.
It does make a big difference, and it's something we really need, we really need to know about. We need to know how chickens are reared. We need to know about, how the animals are treated and so on. We can no longer say that we, in conscience, I mean, I'm absolutely not a vegetarian, but I am not prepared to eat meat where animals or birds or whatever have suffered from what's on my plate. And also, I'm not interested in having something that's loaded with antibiotics and hormones and growth promoters and bone strengtheners and antidepressants.
Well, you've written about your childhood and growing up in the past, and I know there was a wonderful story about your summer spent on a family farm.
That's right.
And you and I haven't grown up through the same era.
Yes.
That we went through this beginning of where all the food was grown. You bought it from the farmer's market, and then all of a sudden came the modern era, the 50s.
Yes,
talk a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I was really so lucky to catch the end of that era, because when I was a child, our summer holidays were not spent like the youngsters are nowadays in Lanzarote or somewhere. You know, we were sent off to our relatives in Tipperary to get a bit of bog air or something, and of course lived with them then for several weeks. at a time. And my on one Aunt Lil and Uncle Bob's farm, they would be saving turf in the summer, and then they had a big dairy herd, of course, or not a particularly big dairy herd, but they made butter every couple of days. So this was all what was going on every day. They killed a pig at the end, or a couple of pigs at the end of the in the autumn, and then the neighbours came in and helped to cut it up, and then you'd share the meat with them, and then I saw them salting down the bacon for the winter and so on. So I learned all these sort of skills. It was just at that time, of course, the skills were passed from one generation to another. That's how you learned how to cook, how to make bread, how to cook over the open fire, all that sort of thing. And gosh, doesn't everything come full circle now? It's all about exactly. Cooking over wood and everything again. So I was really lucky to catch the end of that, actually. And then, of course, I remember the excitement in the country village where I lived in Cullahill in County Leash, with the first instant whip coming to the village and blancmange. And, you know, at that time, it was, of course, a treat. I mean, how ridiculous is this? But to have a packet of fig rolls or spring sprong biscuits or those coconut creams. And so that's what we all wanted. I remember when electricity came to our village. I was about 9 when electricity came to the village. Before that, there were no...
In rural towns.
Yes, but you know, it was only a few years earlier that that electricity came to most of the country. So a lot of people my age, well, are a little older, certainly would remember life before electricity. Mm. And when you think about the paranoia now around food safety and food hygiene, right, and every goddamn thing wrapped up in plastic and so on, you know, it's good to remind ourselves that that refrigeration is only over 100 years old, even in America.
Right.
So, you know, and in a way, we want to be really careful of this, because the more sterile everything is, sometimes the more, you know, depressed our antibodies, our resistances and so on. So, but that's a whole other topic altogether.
Right. Germs are our best friend, according to Michael Pollan, so this is good.
Well, in a way, it's even funny with a lot of my students, when I say to them, what's bacteria? Is it good or bad? And a lot of people think the word bacteria means bad. And it's so very high, over 80% of bacteria are beneficial to us and
come
so
back
on.
To
so
cheese, right?
Exactly, exactly. Well, that's a whole other subject altogether. Right. We're straying off the mark.
Yeah. Well, actually, not really. But what I would like to do is throw out a few terms for our listeners, because you throw them about in your book a lot.
All right, okay.
I think I need to take another language course in order to read some of the recipes.
There we are.
But for those who aren't really familiar with some of the terms, but one is an historic term for a cooking pot, often known as a brazier or
bastable.
A bastable.
Yes. A bastable is, honestly, when I was in the late 50s, when I was a child, we were in this country village again. We were one of the few people in the village who had a cooker. A lot of people would have cooked still over the open fire at that time. So the batterie de cuisine was just a few different cooking pots. So you would have a kettle, you'd have a great big round black-bellied pot kind of thing. And then there was this pot oven sort of thing called a bastable. It was a pot
with a cast iron Dutch oven.
Actually iron. And it had three. It's interesting, from India to whatever, you come across something in very similar shape in many, many countries. But it had just three legs underneath it, and it had a lid on it, and a sort of slightly conical lid with a little lip. And so people would have cooked over the open fire and this, and they would have made bread in it, and they would have cooked stews or even apple tarts or even a goose occasionally in it when they were having it. That would have been a big treat. And then they would have taken embers, hot embers from the fire, and put it on the lid. And then this would have been over the fire, actually often over there was a sort of three-corner kind of stand that it sat on sometimes. But sometimes it was just directly over the open fire. Incredibly skillful to cook in it, because you had to really judge the heat of the fire and the embers on top. And then it cooked, and it was sort of slightly steamy inside, so the crust of the bread would be soft and the bread would be really light and fluffy, you know. But now, so that was called a bastable. I think the word came from... They were manufactured in Barnstable in the UK, as it was one of the places this iron came from, these iron pots came from. So I think that might have been a bastardization of the word Barnstable.
Bastable.
And so, but now we make bastable bread, you make soda bread in a sort of cast iron, sort of like Le Creuset kind of saucepan in the oven, and you get a very similar result, but without the romanticism of cooking over the open fire. But of course, that took incredible skill, that kind of cooking, because there was no, nowadays you turn on an oven and just turn on the thermostat, whereas it took much, our mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers had much more skill in the way that they were able to judge the heat of the...
Right. Put your hand in front of the fire.
Exactly.
And count to three, right?
That's right, exactly, yes.
Well, so many of the foods are still popular today, or once again, you know, a renewed popularity, but they are in fact traditional foods.
Yes.
And, puddings, particularly the black pudding, the black and white
yes.
puddings. Tell me about
yes.
black and white puddings.
Well, again, you see, because the pig was always very important in Irish, the whole Irish life, and so many of the, people, everybody, even in our village, when I was a child, you know, the postmistress, they would have had a couple of pigs. They would have reared a few pigs. Even in cities like Dublin, a lot of people would have kept pigs and then killed them, and of course they would cure them down for the winter. But when you kill a pig, you have, you know, you should really, if possible, use everything from the nose to the tail, and they
right.
did. So of course the blood was every culture has blood puddings, because blood is incredibly nourishing. So the blood was used, the fresh blood was used to make black puddings, and every family had their own recipe for it, and so on. And then the white puddings were made from other bits of pork and the lights and the liver and some, you know, bread crumbs, that kind of thing as well. So there's both brown, at least both black and white puddings are still made in Ireland. The best ones are made from fresh blood, because then they're crumbly and delicious and really, really good. Nowadays, sometimes they use frozen or dried blood for it, but that's nothing like so good. But that's very much part of our tradition, and still, when you have an Irish breakfast in Ireland, with what you call bacon, we call rashers, sausages, black and white pudding, maybe some mushrooms, maybe a bit of fried bread or a potato cake. In the north of Ireland, you would have what they call fadge, which is a potato bread. That would be part of it as well. That would set you up for the day. I can tell you plate of that. Yes,
and the white pudding was made from
the white pudding was made from the little sort of scraps of meat and the lights, which are the lungs and the liver, and so those extra little bits. That was the white pudding was made from that, whereas the black pudding was blood, and then sometimes there was some pinhead oatmeal in it and some spices and so on, and seasoning salts, of course. Yeah.
Well,
and then it was put back into the intestines. I mean, I remember as a child, again on this farm in Tipperary, helping to wash out the intestines and turn them inside out. My little fingers were quite small, so mm-hmm. I could turn them inside out and scrape off the fat off the inside. And that was actually added to the mixture for the black pudding. Sometimes had little small dice of the back fat, which is different. The fats in the pig, you see, they're all render at different temperatures and so on. They have different textures, so yeah, we use them for different things.
And so that's why the puddings are always round. You see them
exactly
sliced up on
yes,
a plate.
And in
right?
France they have the boudin noir, and
yes,
then in,
yes.
in Spain, you know, it's morcilla and so on. They all and I mean, there are references in early Irish manuscripts again to. This was very early on now, when cattle were just introduced, and the Kerry cattle would have been one of the earliest. We actually have Kerrys and Dexters on our farm now. They're one of the earliest breeds in Europe. But they used to, in the winter, they used to bleed the Kerry cattle, and they'd put in something, take it from a vein, because they knew how nutritious the blood was. And there was a saying that the Kerry cows knows it's Sunday, because they didn't bleed them on a Sunday.
Oh.
Yeah, incredible. But yeah. It's just, you know, every ancient culture, as I said, understood the nourishment that came from blood.
Mm. As I mentioned earlier, such a small country, but such a treasure of natural resources. And, of course, from the sea, the fish, I mean, are phenomenal.
Yes.
And
cold
so
water is wonderful, you know, wonderful textured fish. And, of course, a huge variety of fish.
Cold and clean.
Fish.
Cold and clean.
Cold
water.
And right. clean, yeah. Yes, in south and west and the west coast of Ireland. Yes, still very clean waters. We're very fortunate, yeah.
But herring and mackerel were very popular.
They were.
Still are,
and,
I'm sure.
And abundant, of course.
Because they could be put up and stored, right?
Exactly. And they would have been salted down and pickled and exported. There were huge export markets of herrings and mackerel and so on. And then they ate, early on particularly, they ate a lot of shellfish as well. They particularly loved limpets, which are kind of quite chewy, actually. But in a way, people were eating, when people were collecting food, years ago, we forget that they weren't being as fussy about things as we are nowadays. It was absolutely about sustenance and nourishment and feeding people.
I always thought limpets were the barnacles. You know, they're just,
they are.
They are barnacles.
Well, they are
growing
barnacles
on the sides of
they
the rocks.
They totally are. In fact, the Irish, the Gaelic word for it is barnock, and they made a. They used to collect them up to relatively recently. Traditionally, they would collect them on Holy Thursday to eat them on Good Friday. The women, I remember when I was doing research for that traditional food book, going down with the women in Kerry, and with their aprons, they collected them in their aprons, of course they are attached to the rock. They're like little Vietnamese hats, little pointed Vietnamese hats, and that term sticks like a limpet is, apt, because if they hear you coming, they literally cling onto the rocks, and it's very hard to get them off. So we brought down a chisel with us, or if you come quietly, you can take a sharp stone and just give it a quick little knock with the stone, you can knock it off, but it's quite difficult to get them off the rocks, and then you need to cook them, and they can be quite tough and chewy, but they're very tasty.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, but actually, in a way, I think now the more modern way that a lot of chefs use razor clams and things like that is to cut them into very thin slices and toss them with pasta or something.
This was not
known to our ancestors.
Well, there are so many wonderful stories in this book and in your classes and in the school, and
then there's Carrageen.
We didn't talk about the Carrageen.
Yes.
Yes, you threw me on that one
sorry.
Time. Yes, when we were at the Food Network, I was trying to cook a dish for you. You were coming, and we were going to help display some of the food that you had wanted to present on air.
Yeah.
And you called for a agar-agar in a sheet form, gelatin, and carrageen. And we're thinking, where in the world?
We've got to get
tell us about carrageen.
Well, carrageen is an Irish seaweed. I think over here you can buy it as Irish moss, actually. And we collected off the little rocks. Actually, carrageen means little rock in Gaelic. And so after the spring tides every year, when the tides are the furthest out, then we pick, or of course you can buy it in shops if you want to, at health food shops and everything. We just pick this little seaweed off the rocks, and then traditionally it would be brought up and spread out on the sort of spongy grass on the cliffs, and then washed by the rain and bleached by the sun for a few days, and then you can keep it forever. And it's an incredible, of course it's a natural gelatin, as many seaweeds are, and very nutritious, and lots of iodine and other trace elements, and it helps to your metabolism to work to its most efficient, so it breaks down fats and doesn't put on weight. So jockeys and so on really love it as well. But we serve it in Ballymaloe House, which is the Country House Hotel that is attached, we're attached, the school is attached to as well. We serve that at least once or twice a week, and people
as a
pudding. We make a pudding with it. It's called carrageen moss pudding, and then serve it with a compote of fruit, for example. At the moment, it would be poached rhubarb or poached gooseberries with elderflower, because that season is just about to start now. And it's absolutely wonderful. All our babies were weaned onto it as well. It's a wonderful food.
So seaweed plays a big role in a lot of other types of seaweed as well.
Yes. Well, actually, it's interesting you should say that, because Ireland is just waking up to the potential of the seaweed around our coast. So several people now are beginning to harvest the seaweed in a commercial way. And so now our challenge is to make sure that it's harvested sustainably. And, of course, we export quite a bit of seaweed now. But you have to, when you're harvesting seaweed, one needs to make sure to just leave the whole fat still on the rock so that you don't damage the original plant and so
on.
So,
like picking wildflowers.
Yeah, so this is all part of the foraging thing that we do as well. So we do a lot of foraging courses at school
as well. You talk a lot, and of course nettles, there's a huge popularity here in this country too, with serving stinging nettles. And, and people
I
are
saw them down at the Union Square Market this morning. I was down there about 7:30, and there were nettles and, lamb's quarters. It's great to see so many of those wild and foraged foods in the markets now.
I'm often tempted to pull from my garden and throw away. I know that it's something good to eat, but it's some often crowds out everything else that's growing.
Yes, well, it does. Well, then you can eat it.
That's right.
Revenge
that's
and chickweed and all of those things. I mean, it's just interesting that we at the cooking school, we've been doing foraging courses, I suppose, for maybe nearly 20 years now. And in that time, every year I do a course, I learn about more. I think that In a very high percentage of the food that's of the plants that are around us are actually edible, but of course one has to really be sure first. Mm-hmm. But every time I do a course, I learn from the people who are with me about more and more things you can eat, which is fantastic. So you need never be hungry.
It is. And I see pictures of you in a greenhouse and out in a field, surrounded by rows of kale.
Yes.
The cut and come again kale.
Yes.
Right? It comes up again.
Well, it's great that kale has had its moment.
Forever. Hasn't it?
Yeah. My God, we grow about four or five different types of kale, and I think if I was only allowed one of the winter brassicas, it would have to be kale. You just kind of know it's doing you good, don't you? It's just amazing, really. And of course, that used to be cattle food. One stage, yeah. So it's
tough, hard to chew. Until people learned what to do with it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, so this again was part of the food of our ancestors.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing it, because there's so much to learn from our ancestors.
Exactly.
And all these, and I think botanists who are identifying these plants, which they know from their studies are edible, but people have been ignoring them or treating them as weeds for a long time.
Absolutely. It's wonderful the way seems to be new and very avant-garde now. If we look back, we can see that our ancestors and pre-ancestors really knew exactly what to do, because they had to. They really had to be in touch with nature, because otherwise they wouldn't have survived. And so there's very little new under the sun.
That's true. What a great note to close on. Thank you so much. A Taste of the Past from Ireland. Thank you so much, Dorina Allen. And I've been your host, Linda Palacio.
Oh, thank you so much, Linda. That was great. I hope I wasn't...
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.